From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour today, my guest is Iowa native and Grinnell College graduate Greg Thielman. Thielman is a senior fellow at the Arms Control Association in Washington. He's been instrumental in pushing for ratification of the New START Treaty, a bilateral nuclear arms reduction treaty between the U.S. and Russia. Then we talk with Henry Levine, senior director for Stonebridge China, a consulting firm that advises clients on China-related strategies and plans. Levine will discuss U.S.-China relations during a stop at Drake University. That's all coming up this hour. First, let's look at the news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest in the first half hour is Greg Thielman. Thielman made news in 2003 after retiring from his position as director of the Strategic Proliferation and Military Affairs Office at the State Department's Intelligence Bureau. He openly criticized the false information that was used then to gain support for launching the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Iraq. Thielman is an Iowa native and Grinnell College graduate. He's now a senior fellow at the Arms Control Association. That's a public education organization. Greg Thielman spoke yesterday at Grinnell College. The title of his talk, Nuclear Arms Control, What's the Rush? Greg Thielman, in our studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Thank you, Ben.
Let's get right to the heart of your message about arms control. To many of us, the world seems so much safer now than it did in the Cold War when we grew up. The U.S. and the USSR then pointing thousands of missiles at each other with the thought that mutual assured destruction would keep us safe. So what is the rush now?
In many ways, the world is much safer because relations between the U.S. and Russia are much better than relations were between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But one of the points I made yesterday and would like to reiterate today is that we still face two dangers. One is the chance of a nuclear war between the countries that have nuclear weapons, a remote chance, but one that would obviously have catastrophic consequences for the entire planet. And we have a new danger with the rise of groups like al-Qaeda, non-governmental terrorist groups who are interested in creating as many casualties in an American city as they could. These groups are very interested in acquiring nuclear weapons. And the new concern is that there are more countries with nuclear weapons, countries, some of them like Pakistan, that are not particularly secure. And you still have the enormous Cold War arsenals in Russia of thousands of tactical nuclear weapons, which are an ideal thing for a nuclear terrorist to get his hands on. So we have dangers left over from the Cold War and new dangers. All of these things can be addressed by the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty that we have concluded with Russia, but there is a window of opportunity which is closing. We need to move promptly on this.
Okay, I want to talk about the details more in detail about New START in just a moment. Earlier this month, though, you wrote an opinion piece for the Omaha World Herald advocating the prompt ratification of this new arms reduction treaty, New START. But before we get to the details of that and why you advocated, I want you to tell us about a part in your op-ed piece where you take us back to your youth. And I think it will remind a lot of our listeners, it certainly reminded me of the era that we grew up in, the Cold War. Your thoughts, your remembrances.
Well, I was born in 1950, and I do have memories of being in a car in Iowa, looking at the western horizon, thinking about the consequences of a nuclear exchange. And one of the most important targets for Soviet nuclear missiles would have been Omaha, Nebraska, because it's the headquarters then of the Strategic Air Command, now called the Strategic Forces Command. And one of the consequences, if there had been a nuclear exchange, would have been a very spectacular sunrise on the western horizon as Soviet nuclear warheads slammed into Omaha and essentially digging out the deep underground command posts that controlled U.S. strategic forces. And it would not only have been that explosion, but an enormous mushroom cloud would have arisen from Omaha, the prevailing prevailing winds would have carried deadly radioactive fallout over central Iowa. So it was a very real concern at the time that one way or another we would have been catastrophically affected by that nuclear exchange. And even I could imagine that as a young
right. So is that horrific image that you had in Newton, Iowa, led to your career in arms control?
It was one of the things influencing my interest in international affairs and in getting agreements to reduce the nuclear danger.
Now, also in your talk yesterday afternoon at Grinnell, you said that something interesting I'd like you to expand on. During the Cold War, in your words, the threat came not only from the explosive potential of the two enormous nuclear arsenals and the environmental impact of building them, but from the ignorance and or deception of political leaders who controlled those arsenals. Explain what you mean and give us an example or two.
Well, I gave a number of examples that in many cases the arguments for additional U.S. defense spending were based on what I think it's now safe to say were exaggerated estimates of the Soviet military threat. This really starts from the missile and bomber gap of the late 50s that was part of the 1960s political campaign. We found out later there wasn't really a gap. And that line of argumentation led to what was the largest buildup of any side in the Cold War era. It was the U.S. modernizing all three legs of our own triad, creating thousands of nuclear warheads. So President Reagan's line saying that Brezhnev was engaged in the largest strategic buildup in modern history wasn't really accurate. It was the U.S. buildup, which is larger. There were a number of other inaccuracies during that period that were not only wrong, like when the Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger under Reagan said that that Soviet missiles were more accurate than U.S. missiles. That was exactly wrong, 180 degrees wrong. U.S. missiles were much more accurate, and that was one of the reasons why our missiles didn't need to be as big as the Soviet missiles, because they could place nuclear weapons much closer to the intended target.
So fast forward to the 21st century, the Cold War is long since over. To what extent is this ignorance and or distortion a threat today as you see it?
Well, I think a much more recent example, obviously, is during the invasion of Iraq. It was based on assumptions about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and most importantly, nuclear weapons. We now know, of course, that the nuclear weapons program that Saddam Hussein did have before the first Gulf War had been effectively dismantled by UN authorities and had not been reconstituted. But the chief pillar of President George W. Bush's case against Iraq was that the Iraqi nuclear weapons program was being reconstituted, and that within a fairly short period of time, Iraq would have nuclear weapons. That was not only untrue, but I think it's fair to say that based on the intelligence available to the U.S. administration before the invasion in March of 2003, the U.N. inspectors back in Iraq on the ground demonstrated that the assumptions behind that assessment were incorrect.
Greg Thielman is with us, if you just joined us. Greg is an Iowa native, graduate of Grinnell College, where he spoke yesterday afternoon about arms control. He's a senior fellow now at the Arms Control Association. So let's talk now about New START, this latest arms control agreement, just voted out of committee in the Senate less than 2 weeks ago. If implemented, if ratified, what does it require of the U.S. and Russia? And it really is a treaty, a bilateral treaty, right?
Yes. And we sometimes at the Arms Control Association describe it as a modest treaty, modest because we would have hoped for deeper cuts and faster cuts. But we also point out that it's extremely significant and extremely important. The treaty itself would reduce the limits on strategic warheads between the two sides by about 30%. It will reduce the number of what we call launchers, that is the intercontinental ballistic missiles, the sea-launch ballistic missiles, and the heavy bombers by 50% from the limits that were part of the original START treaty. And so this is the main kind of limitations, significant in the sense that literally hundreds of Russian nuclear warheads will be destroyed in order for Russia to get under the limits of the treaty. In the U.S. case, there will also be significant numbers of weapons destroyed. So we'll have lower limits of nuclear weapons. And the U.S. and Russia both these days size their arsenals based on what the other party has. So it makes perfect sense if we can both agree to reduce our weapons, then we are both better off. We still have nuclear deterrents, but we pay a lot less for them.
Now, a few days ago, as a matter of fact, I think a couple of weeks ago, John Bolton, Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security from 2001 to 2005 under President Bush, now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, he wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal arguing against ratifying New START. He wrote, quote, "Less well understood but profoundly misguided is the treaty's return to outmoded Cold War limits on weapons launchers, which will require the United States but not Russia to dismantle existing delivery systems. This could cripple America's long-range conventional warhead delivery capabilities," writes Bolton, "while also severely constraining our nuclear flexibility. We will pay for this mistake in future conflicts entirely unrelated to Russia." React to these scathing words about New START from John Bolton.
Well, it's not surprising that John Bolton would have problems with this treaty, because he was quite proud of the 2002 Moscow Treaty that he was the principal negotiator of, which did reduce limits in operational deployed warheads. However, it had no definition of what exactly was being reduced, and it had no verification mechanism. I mean, it was a treaty that I often describe as a sham treaty, in that you can't have effective arms control if you have no effective verification. John Bolton's treaty was 3 pages long. It had no definition. It's quite clear today, in fact, that the Russians didn't even accept the definition of what a bomber weapon was. So John Bolton has a stake in the old-style arms control that he championed, and he was quite proud at the time, in fact, advertising this was the last arms control agreement. That's what he said. He didn't even want a treaty in 2002.
What about his security concerns having to do with the ceiling of, I believe, 700 launchers crippling us or somehow hampering us in conflicts in the future entirely unrelated to Russia?
Well, John Bolton has a unique position now of being one of the only people who had significant national security responsibilities in any of the past administrations who was against the prompt ratification of this treaty. The commander of the Strategic Forces is in favor of it. The 7 previous commanders of Strategic Forces Command are in favor of it. The senior military leadership has all said that one of the virtues of this treaty, it gives U.S. forces significant flexibility between the legs of the triad, more flexibility than the first START treaty had. So they describe the current treaty as being flexible, and that being one of the primary advantages of it.
Traditionally, ratification has been of arms treaties has been bipartisan. Is it going to be a problem getting this ratified with the current Congress?
It has already been a problem. You're correct. Traditionally, strategic arms reduction agreements have carried by wide margins. They require a 2/3 vote in the Senate, which all treaties do. And under most circumstances, that should not be a problem. This treaty is well protected against the usual criticisms of arms control agreements, partly because of the flexibility that I just alluded to. There's plenty of flexibility for the U.S. There's good verification. There's ways for us, if there were significant cheating on the other side, that we could quickly compensate for that. So everything is lined up for prompt passage. The problem is that the treaty has gotten ensnared in the highly partisan-charged atmosphere in the U.S. Senate now. And the support for Republicans for this agreement, which should carry the majority of Republicans, has been hampered by Senator Kyle and others seeing a political advantage in delaying this ratification vote.
I want to talk about a couple of the related issues that we see in the news here, Iran specifically. We continue hearing about the new enrichment plants in Iran, accusations of continuing of Iran using its nuclear, civilian nuclear program as a cover to make nuclear weapons. Now, how does Iran, it doesn't figure in, this is a bilateral treaty, how will that situation, for example, be affected by this treaty?
I would argue ratification of this treaty is one of the best things we could do for our efforts to control nuclear weapons developments in North Korea and Iran, because we need help from third parties, not just Russia and the U.S. We need to demonstrate to the rest of the world that the U.S. is not worshiping at the nuclear altar, that the U.S. and Russia, which have 95% of the nuclear weapons in the entire world, are taking seriously their obligation under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty to move toward a reduction of our arsenals. And it is only because of that that we were able to get in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty the agreement of countries that don't have nuclear weapons, that they would a commitment that they would not develop them and they would stop other countries from getting them. So we need to get the help of other countries to help prevent Iran and North Korea from increasing arsenals.
Would you agree that the Iranian president has his eyes set on acquiring nuclear weapons?
I am agnostic on that. The U.S. intelligence community has not said definitively that Iran wants to have nuclear weapons. It is said that its best judgment is that Iran wants a nuclear capability, which means they want enough technology that they could quickly develop nuclear weapons. But our task is to convince the Iranians not to make that decision to develop nuclear weapons, at a better path is to be transparent enough in their nuclear program to persuade the UN that it is a peaceful nuclear program, and then Iran can harvest the benefits of cooperation with other countries and get rid of the sanctions it's currently under.
We hear about the possibility of a surgical strike against Iran on its nuclear facilities. We can assume, can't we, that the plans for such an attack are drawn up, if not multiple plans, ready to go?
We can assume the military has contingency plans for that scenario, as they do many others, but it's also quite obvious that senior military leaders of the United States, almost to a person, have warned about the consequences of a military attack on Iran. There is no U.S. military leader who is keen to be ordered to attack Iran, because they all know, as Secretary of Defense has said, that an attack, even if it were successful at destroying the immediate objectives, Iran would develop in 2 or 3 years, it would rebuild its arsenal. So it would be a formula for ultimately a U.S. invasion and occupation of Iran in an effort to permanently keep Iran from getting nuclear weapons. And I don't think that America is ready for invading another country in the Middle East.
Let's talk a little bit about the other threat that you mentioned at the beginning, terrorists. What do you see as the most likely scenario for a terrorist group acquiring, setting off a nuclear weapon in the U.S.?
It is not an easy thing for a terrorist to do. Nuclear weapons are generally well secured. What one worries about most is a situation like Pakistan, which has undergone horrible flooding recently, has large swaths of the country that it really has no effective control over. It has an unstable political environment, and the fear is that some of Pakistan's nuclear weapons might be captured or stolen from a terrorist group.
Where is the most problematic part of that chain? Acquiring the weapon, you've got to get it to the U.S., you've got to deliver it. Now, is that problematic for a terrorist?
All of these things are obstacles, and vectors are provide possibilities for us of interception. But if one can imagine the number of containers coming into the United States every day from abroad, most of which are not inspected at all, it's an enormous challenge to close out all of these options of getting something into the country. And one of the reasons why it is so important to get a grip on overall numbers, and particularly the Russian tactical nuclear weapon stockpile, is some of those weapons are small enough that they could be more easily hidden, much smaller than the kind of weapons we have carried by bombers or on the top of ICBMs.
How much confidence do you have in our homeland security that we can find those in a shipping container?
I don't have complete confidence. The best way to stop this awful prospect is to secure the weapons at their source, not hope that we will somehow intercept them on the way to the United States.
Yesterday at the United Nations, North Korea vowed to, quote, bolster its nuclear deterrent in response to the threat posed by the United States, it said. But it promised also never to use its atomic arsenal to attack or threaten any nation. How much should we worry about North Korea, especially considering its strange and secretive leadership?
Well, North Korea deserves to be near the top of our list of countries about which we are concerned. Iran and North Korea are the chief proliferation challenges. North Korea is generally in a very weak position, and it's not even clear that they have an operationally deliverable nuclear weapon.
But they do have a nuclear weapon.
But they have had two nuclear tests. Mm-hmm. They clearly have at least mastered the physics. So that is a high priority for the U.S. to get a grip on this nuclear arsenal. I personally think that the North Koreans are doing it for defensive purposes. In their minds, this is a way to prevent a U.S. invasion of North Korea, and I think they genuinely are concerned about that. So I actually don't think it helps much for us to talk about invading either North Korea or Iran. It just feeds the arguments of those who wish to develop their nuclear arsenals as a defense against us.
Mm-hmm. Are there other countries you would put in the worrying list of the nations with nuclear weapons or about to acquire nuclear weapons?
No other nations are about to acquire, but there are other nations that have either the resources in terms of money or the human capital necessary to pursue a nuclear weapons program. And so one has to look at countries like Egypt and Turkey, just to mention the Middle East, or countries like Saudi Arabia that could obviously fund foreign work. And one has to build the barriers to this happening and strengthen the International Atomic Energy Agency and take other international steps to make sure that the danger from these countries is minimized.
We have about a minute left, and in the next segment we're going to be talking about the U.S.-China economic relations. I'd like you to address China in this context and their nuclear arsenal. How do they figure into the picture as an emerging power?
China is a little bit complicated for 1 minute, but I'll do my best. China has a little over 40 nuclear warheads that they could target the United States with. That's compared to our own 2,000 nuclear warheads. So the first thing to say is that China is not in the same league of the U.S. and Russia at all. We're not even close to being in the same league. And China is slowly building up its nuclear forces, but China has a nuclear doctrine that says it will never use nuclear weapons first. I wish the U.S. had such a doctrine. We should say that we will only use nuclear weapons in response to a nuclear attack. We have not even done that.
Okay, Greg Thielman, thank you very much. Iowa native, grew up in Newton. Thank you for your memories. Growing up in Newton in the Cold War, also your thoughts on the New START Treaty. Greg Thielman is the senior fellow at the Arms Control Association. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we talk with Hank Levine, a senior vice president with the Albright Stonebridge Group in Washington, D.C. Levine will discuss U.S.-China relations during a stop at Drake University in the coming days. We'll talk with him in just a moment. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. On November 2nd, voters will decide whether to amend Iowa's Constitution. Tomorrow on this program, we discuss a proposed amendment on the ballot that would create a dedicated trust fund for protecting and enhancing water quality, natural areas, and Iowa soils. The measure would ensure that a portion of any future sales tax increase would be put into the Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund. We'll talk about that tomorrow, the benefits of such a trust fund, as well as budgetary concerns, tomorrow, Friday, over the noon hour on The Exchange. Well, when it comes to geopolitics on issue after issue, climate change, North Korea, Iran, global health issues, and others, China is a major player, growing in importance. This is especially true for global economic issues. China continues to be the center of much debate in Washington, around the country as well, but everyone agrees that China's emergence as a growing power, both economically and politically, is changing the global landscape. Joining me for the rest of the hour to discuss the U.S.-China economic relationship, Hank Levine, Senior Vice President of the Albright Stonebridge Group in Washington, D.C. Hank Levine has had more than 25 years of experience as a U.S. diplomat, trade negotiator. He served 4 years as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Asia in the Clinton administration. Levine will discuss U.S.-China relations, economic relations, during a stop at Drake University Monday, October 4th at 7 p.m. in Meredith Hall at Drake University. Hank Levine joins us now by phone for the rest of the hour. Good afternoon to you.
Great. Good afternoon to you. Delighted to be with you.
Tell us quickly, before we get on to some of the issues, what is the Albright Stonebridge Group?
We're a strategic advisory firm, to use the language of Washington. Basically, we work with companies that operate overseas, in my case focused on China, though we work around the world, primarily U.S. companies, though not exclusively so, giving them advice, helping them improve their access to markets in other countries, solve problems with foreign governments, and so on. So doing our bit to promote the growth of U.S. company activities.
Okay, to start, let's summarize the character of U.S.-China economic relationship as you see it. Which areas, in brief, are especially promising? Which areas are troubling?
Well, I think the overall, let me say, I think that the U.S.-China relations overall are generally quite good. With regard to the economic relationship, I think many Americans are not aware of the extent to which we have seen an explosion of U.S. exports to China, to the point that China is now our second largest export market after our NAFTA partners, so after Canada and Mexico. And I think there continues to be a lot of opportunities for exports, including, of course, as I think many folks in your state know, particularly in the agricultural area. Mm-hmm. U.S. companies operating in China, generally those who have invested there, generally have done quite well. The vast majority of them report that they have been profitable. That's the positive side, and I think there's a lot of the positive that will continue. On the negative side, I think over the last couple of years, we have seen some increasing efforts by the Chinese government to implement some policies that are aimed at protecting or supporting Chinese companies, particularly in the high technology area, and disadvantaging foreign companies in the China market. And there's a large basket of policies, and I think that is the main area of concern for most foreign companies today.
Okay, let's go in depth about those in a moment. But you mentioned this explosion of exports that most Americans are not aware of, U.S. exports to China, especially that would include Iowa exporting agricultural goods to China. What is behind this explosion of exports? What's changed?
Well, you know, China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, and as a part of that process, they committed to significantly opening their market. So on the one hand, over the period since then, we have seen the removal of many policies and the implementation of new policies that have allowed increased access by foreign companies in the China market. So that's one piece of it, is sort of the policy and regulatory side. At the same time, of course, China's just been having fabulous economic growth at the rate of 9 or 10% a year. This, of course, has driven a huge amount of demand for products, both agricultural as well as machinery and chemicals and all other kinds of products. So on the one hand, it's been the implementation of the WTO, the World Trade Organization commitments, and on the other hand, China's strong economic growth that has drawn in large numbers of products from abroad.
Okay. My guest for this half hour is Hank Levine, Senior Senior Vice President of the Albright-Stonebridge Group in Washington, D.C., will be addressing U.S.-China relations in a few days at Drake University. If you have a question about U.S.-China economic relations, give us a call, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email for any questions, concerns you have about our economic relationship with China. Now, Mr. Levine, so much we hear about, and you haven't mentioned it yet, and that surprises me a little bit, about the currency. Yesterday, the U.S. House approved legislation aimed at addressing the value of the yuan and our trade deficit with the country. This is not at the top of your list of concerns?
Well, you're right. It is not at the top of my list, and I think it's fair to say that it is not at the top of the list for most of the large foreign companies, the multinational companies that operate in China. I think the currency issue has become politically sensitive here in Washington, but it is my view that it is in fact less important for jobs in the United States, for the future competitiveness of the United States. It is less important than these kinds of issues that I mentioned that the Chinese government has been pursuing over the last few years. You know, most of the products, not all, but most of the products that we import from China haven't been made in the U.S. for quite some time, and this particularly applies to things like apparel and shoes, and even things like laptop computers that are assembled in China. They're done there only because of the low wages. If China's currency appreciates in value and products from China become more expensive, most of those jobs are not moving back to the U.S. They'll move to other developing countries with even lower wages, including, for example, Vietnam and others. So I don't believe that the currency issue is particularly significant for jobs in the U.S. or for U.S. competitiveness. I think there are other issues I wish the Congress were spending more time on.
Let's talk specifically about Iowa and China. How does Iowa benefit from our relationship with China in specifics?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you know, on the agriculture side, China is an enormous market for ag products. In particular, in the period, and this is reflected in large part in Iowa's success, in the period, for example, 2000 to 2009, Iowa's exports to China increased by 722%.
722%, you said?
In the period 2000 to 2009, that's right. And at the same time, Iowa's exports to the rest of the world increased only 96%. So as I say, in part because of an increased openness in the market and in part because of a huge demand in China with a growing economy, it's been a tremendous success story. And I would add that even in the midst of the economic crisis, if we look at the year 2009 compared with the year 2008, in that one-year period, Iowa's exports to China increased a tiny bit, 0.2%. Mm-hmm. However, Iowa's exports to the rest of the world fell by 26%. So again, even in that very difficult period, China was at least, you know, not a major loss, and in fact, there was a tiny increase. So I think the direct benefits alone to Iowa from exports are tremendously clear.
Can you say whether Iowa is benefiting from the U.S. relationship, economic relationship with China, more than, generally speaking, more than other U.S. states?
I couldn't say. I haven't really looked in detail to make that comparative analysis. Mm-hmm. Again, I would say that overall, the U.S. agricultural sector as a whole has been one of the biggest beneficiaries of China's increased openness and its demand for products. So clearly, ag exports have been a huge success story. And I know that delights our current Secretary of Agriculture, who himself, I know, hails from Iowa. So I couldn't specifically say, but certainly the agricultural, the U.S. agricultural exports in general, exporters have been huge beneficiaries.
Your questions for Hank Levine. He's with us for the rest of the hour. 1-866-780-9100 about the U.S.-China economic relationship. 1-866-780-9100. The exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Dubuque, where Greg is listening. Hi, Greg.
Hello. My question is, Hank, you had stated that one of the main reasons that companies are moving overseas is chasing low labor costs, and with labor costs rising in China, they're moving to other sources of low labor, such as Vietnam and so forth. I'm wondering your opinion on whether that strategy is proving to be effective for companies in Iowa and internationally here. And also, if you could comment on your understanding of lean manufacturing principles. And I'll listen to the response on air.
Okay. Greg, thank you for the question from Dubuque.
Good. Thanks. With regard to the latter question, I'm probably not the person to offer lots of insights on lean manufacturing. With regard to the initial question, I'd say the following, that, you know, there is, of course, a lot of heat and emotion and debate on the question of U.S. companies going overseas to manufacture. I would say my perspective is that in most cases, the companies just don't have a choice. And the issue becomes, do I find a lower wage or a lower cost place to produce, or do I go out of business? Our European competitors, our Japanese competitors, other U.S. competitors are following this strategy. So often the company simply has no choice. With regard to how well that strategy is working, and again, I haven't looked specifically at Iowa companies alone. However, the statistic is in multiple surveys that have been done by the U.S.-China Business Council and by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing, something in the neighborhood of 70% or so of their members, and these are companies operating in China, report that they are profitable in China. So I think there's a huge amount of success for those companies. And in fact, roughly 40%, again, in those surveys, 40% of the members report that their profit margins in China are higher than the global profit margins for their companies. Now, again, remember that these are profits that U.S. companies are earning. And these are profits that can be brought back to the U.S. They can pay pensions for retired workers. They can fund R&D. A perfect example, let me just say quickly, is General Motors, which, despite the enormous problems that it's had back here in the U.S., has been tremendously successful and profitable in China. And I think that ultimately GM's workers benefit as the company is able to add profits there. So certainly there are companies that have gone abroad and have gone to China and failed. But overall, I think number one, very often they're forced to do it. And number two, the overall success rate in recent years has been pretty high.
Now, for many years, we've been hearing about China as this global giant awakening, and it's clear that China is becoming more and more a global power. Sort of that giant awakening image gives us something like a Gulliver's Travel image, Gulliver's Travels image of this. And I'm wondering, and I think many people are wondering, to what extent has this giant awakened, and how much is still to come?
Well, I think we're I'm tempted to say sort of in the middle of the process, though in fact maybe we're at the early stages, and there really are a couple of elements here. One is China's own internal domestic development, and as striking as China's economic growth has been over the past decade, most observers, including, for example, the World Bank and other economists, expect China to continue to have very high economic growth for the coming decade. So this process of China growing as an economy and growing in strength is expected to continue. At the same time, the real challenge here and the real issue is how does China and the rest of the world work together to integrate this rising power into the global system? How do we ensure that China, as it becomes more actively involved in international organizations like the UN, like the World Trade Organization, as it has disputes with its other countries in the region, for example, the disputes it's having with Japan now, very recently, how can we ensure that these are settled peacefully and that China and the rest of the world come together and proceed on the basis of agreed rules and norms? You know, we have in the course of history examples of new powers that have arisen in the world and have not been integrated into the existing system. Many people point to Germany, for example, in the 1930s and 40s, and the result of that, of course, was World War II. I believe we can do better with regard to China, but the challenge is how does this all come together? And in terms of that process, I think we are very much at the beginning of the process.
Are there any indications that China, as it grows economically, geopolitically, and its influence, that it will not come off peacefully, that China, as it gains the upper hand economically, will pose, to some degree, a geopolitical threat?
I do not believe it is inevitable that China becomes a geopolitical threat. On the other hand, avoiding that will require a lot of far-sighted leadership on the part of the Chinese government, as well as the governments of the U.S. and the other major countries in the world. Recently, I would say, there has been a little bit of a trend that has raised some concern among many observers, including some of China's neighboring countries. Following the financial crisis, there has been within China some growing sense that China, which came through the financial crisis very well, there's been a sense that maybe China is on the rise and the U.S. and some of the other large countries are slowly going into decline. And I think some observers feel that China, as a result, has become perhaps a little bit too overconfident and a little bit too aggressive, for example, in its recent territorial dispute with Japan. Having said that, again, I don't think the future on this is written in stone. The fact is China's economy is highly linked with the U.S. and other countries around the world. And again, as I say, I believe that with far-sighted leadership, we can wind up succeeding in integrating China into the global system.
Just a couple of minutes left with Hank Levine, our guest for this half hour, talking about U.S.-China economic relations. Let's squeeze in a call at the end of our segment here. Pete is calling from northern Missouri. Hi, Pete.
Yes, sir. Question for Mr. Levine. Seems like we got $13.5 trillion in debt. That's propped up by China and Saudi Arabia primarily, as are probably the biggest buyers. And it seems like that relationship is only because they rely on us being such large consumers. But if China, with its huge population, has got a 10% economic growth, it seems that their middle class, their consumer class, would outpace ours very soon. And so you've got these two countries that aren't necessarily very friendly to us on other terms. Why would they continue to prop up our debt?
Okay, Pete, we'll have to leave it there. We've got about a minute for a response. Thank you, Pete, for calling from northern Missouri.
Thank you.
Good. Well, thank you for the question. And by the way, let me say that when we think about China and the challenges it poses, I certainly do believe that the most important things we can do are the things we do at home for Americans to consume less and save more and get our own house in order. I should say that the Chinese government is very committed to increasing consumption in China, increasing demand. And you're right, at that point, they will export less to us. and more of their products will stay at home. Hopefully, as I say, we will at the same time be readjusting our economy so we are consuming less and saving more, and then our trade flows and financial flows with China can become more in balance than they are today.
Hank Levine, thank you very much. Senior Vice President of the Albright Stonebridge Group in Washington, D.C. Hank Levine will be discussing U.S.-China economic relations in depth on Monday, October 4th at 7 p.m., Meredith Hall at Drake University. Hank, thank you very much for joining us this half hour.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. And we do enjoy ever so much hearing your comments. You can write us anytime, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.